Today on Wings, a scholar who studies the interface between women and technology. Professor Ellen Balka from Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, Canada, talked about her unusual research on things that women have to figure out and do to make technology function in real life.
I like to tell people that I have a very voyeuristic job. I watch people work.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
This is Frieda Worden, and my guest today is Ellen Balka. Tell me a little bit about your credentials, Ellen.
I have a really strange background. I have an undergrad degree in geography and environmental studies. I have a master's degree in women's studies. I got the first master's degree in women's studies in the country. And my doctorate is also from SFU. It's an interdisciplinary doctorate by special arrangements in computer science, communication, and women's studies. And what I've always studied is the impacts of technology on women.
Wow. And you got one of the biggest research grants that this university is having.
In a competition through the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada, both myself and my research group were very fortunate to successfully compete in a funding program called the Initiative for the New Economy, and it's a program called the Collaborative Research Initiative, and this allowed us to get $750,000 a year for 4 years to look at the role of technology in the production, consumption, and use of health information from both a policy and practice perspective. I'm the principal investigator, which means that at the end of the day, I'm administratively and I suppose intellectually responsible for the project. But we have quite a big team. So we have about 22 or 23 other academics, some of whom are Canadian and some of whom are from Australia, Austria, the UK, and the Netherlands. And each of those academics has also brought one or more community partners to the table. I actually also hold an appointment at Vancouver Coastal Health as a research scientist. And I most frequently work in Vancouver General Hospital, but we also are doing work in community clinic settings, Vancouver Public Library, and we're doing some work looking at web-based delivery of health information. What we've mostly done at the hospital is I like to tell people that I have a very voyeuristic job. I watch people work. We go to the hospital and we watch frontline staff interact with technology while they're doing their jobs. We actually go out onto the floors where they're performing their jobs, watch them interact with the technologies they have to use in their everyday work lives. And through that observation, as well as interviews with staff, we're able to identify problems and challenges they're facing in relation to the introduction of the technology into their workplace. We document that information and we take that information back to the people responsible for implementing the technology and make suggestions about how they can improve things from the perspective of frontline staff.
So what kinds of technology are being introduced now into the hospital setting that haven't been there before?
Well, one of my personal favorite technologies is something called an automatic drug dispensing machine. And what the automatic drug dispensing machine does, it was introduced for a number of reasons. One of those reasons is cost containment, to keep control of the drug stock on the ward, to be able to control drugs, to reduce adverse, what we call adverse events in the health system, by making a tighter control on the medication inventory. It ought to reduce incidences where a patient is given the wrong drug or the wrong dosage or the wrong combination of drugs. And it also, because of the close monitoring of the drug supply that's involved with the automatic drug dispensing machine, ought to cut down on staff abuse of drugs, which unfortunately does happen from time to time. So what the automatic drug dispensing machine is it's a metal cabinet. It comes in a bunch of different models. Some of them are three drawers, some of them are six drawers or eight drawers, and on top of this metal cabinet is a keyboard and a little tiny computer screen. And when a nurse has to administer drugs to a patient, the nurse goes to this cabinet and she or he enters in information first about themselves. You have to submit a password and so on, an ID and a password to gain access to the system, and then you have to indicate who your patient is, and then you have to type in information that allows you to select which drugs you require from the cabinet, and each time you type in a drug, then it unlocks the drawer and lights up the little kind of compartment within the drawer and allows you to remove the drugs that you need. There's also a process where the staff then have to count back. They have to verify that the amount of drug in a particular drawer matches what the inventory on the computer shows is there, and so on. And so they go through this process and they get all their medications, and then they go off and they dispense the medication. So prior to the existence of this particular technology, the drugs were kept in a cabinet on the ward. Some of the drugs, in fact, still are kept on a cabinet on the ward. And you didn't have to go through this process of entering your ID, entering your password, indicating who your patient was, and so on. Certainly there was and remains a very tight process for narcotics with multiple signings and so on. But the automatic drug dispensing machine has changed quite a lot. One of the things that's changed is the workflow to pharmacy, because this system is not just a standalone unit, but it's plugged into the hospital-wide pharmacy inventory system. And so pharmacy techs used to come out to the units and see what inventory was required and stock the med carts on the units. And now what happens is they obviously still have to come out and bring the stock up to the units, but in fact the machine produces an automatic inventory record, sometimes wrong, but that goes down to pharmacy, and pharmacy then knows what to bring up without actually coming up first. So that's the automatic drug dispensing machines are one technology.
Wait. Now, let's not leave the automatic drug dispensing machine, because you've just given a really excellent example of something that sounds quite new. But you're observing people interact with this machine. So what kinds of unexpected interactions, or maybe expected interactions, are you observing that would give you impressions about this machine and whether it's well designed or not?
Well, there are a number of things that we've observed, and what I should say is this technology was introduced at Vancouver General Hospital in conjunction with the opening of a new building. And we did an observationally based study during and after the move into the new building, and this was one of several, virtually every technology in the building was brand new. The automatic drug dispensing machines were one of those technologies. So staff faced some pretty significant challenges. They walked into a building they didn't know their way around in because the building was brand new, and everywhere they turned, the technology that they were interacting with was brand new, and it's pretty hard to imagine what that would look like. But just to kind of paint a picture of this, the beds in this building actually plug into the wall, so that if a patient goes to get out of bed and the patient shouldn't be getting out of bed, that actually sets off an alarm so the staff member knows and can go and tend to the patient. And there's a new alarm system in place, so the staff also had to learn about what all the different visual and audible signals were for the alarm. And then on top of that, we had things like the automatic drug dispensing machines. So there was an awful lot of new technology all at one time. And so the automatic drug dispensing machine, some of the kinds of challenges that staff faced is not all the drugs at this point are actually kept in the automatic drug dispensing machines. So there are two supplies of drugs. There's something called unit stock drugs or ward drugs, and then there's something called personal medications. So unit stock drugs are, for example, if you're on the orthopedic floor, there are certain antibiotics they give routinely after certain kinds of surgeries, and you know, you might have stuff like Tylenol and that kind of stuff that would be kept in the automatic drug dispensing machine. It's something that your physician in the hospital would have probably prescribed to you, as opposed to you may be diabetic, let's say, and your insulin for your diabetes would be prescribed by your family physician. And that medication that you would come into the hospital requiring would be in what's considered the personal med card. So one of the challenges is that the staff faced is that they never really quite knew initially which medications were where. Should they be going to the automatic drug dispensing machine for something, or would they find it on the med cart? So that was one issue they faced. One of the other challenges they faced is there's something called a MAR. And, you know, it's really interesting. Everybody refers to MARS sheets, and it's MAR. Nobody has really been able to tell me what MAR stands for, which is just kind of interesting that these things fade into the background. But the MAR sheet is a sheet that comes up from a pharmacy that tells the staff on the unit what medications have been prescribed and should be administered at what times to each patient on the unit. And the MARS are, if you can imagine, old accordion fan-folded computer paper. They kind of look like that, and they come up in a stack and so on, and they have to be kept together, and they have to be kept near the drugs, because you need to refer to the MARs as you're doing your drug administration. So one of the challenges staff have faced is there's one set of MARs, and the physical location on most units where the automatic drug dispensing machine is located is geographically separate from the physical location where the old medication cart that holds the patient's medications is located. And so it presents a challenge for staff because they have to go find the MAR and sometimes take the MAR with them to another location, which means it's not available in the first location. So that was a problem that staff have had to face, is figuring out how to organize their work when the physical locations from which they administer medications are different. They've had to sort out what medications are stored where. And one of the other interesting things was that the automatic drug dispensing machine has essentially an inventory of drugs pre-programmed into it. And most of the nursing staff and pharmacy staff working on a unit are accustomed to, let's say, the generic names for the drug. And the automatic drug dispensing machine might be programmed with the trade names of the drug. Same drug, but the challenge is that a staff member is actually operating on the basis of an enormous amount of tacit knowledge. And with the introduction of the automatic drug dispensing machine, the tacit knowledge that they had didn't always necessarily help them. So the staff had to go through a process, for example, of translating between the generic name for a drug and the trade name for a drug in order to find the drug on the inventory list of the automatic drug dispensing machine, which they had to do before they could actually figure out how to get the machine to liberate the medications for them to administer. So I'm sure this seems like quite a lot of detail, probably too much, but I think the takeaway message is that the introduction of any new technology into a complex work organization changes the flow of work, and there needs to be some understanding of how frontline staff experience that, because it does change how the work is performed. It changes how people interact with one another. As my example with the two different physical locations for the medication carts suggests, sometimes the spatial layout of the work changes, and we tend to operate on the basis that technology will solve problems, and we tend to forget that there are all these other issues that come along with it that really need to be addressed if a technology is to be successfully implemented.
On Wings, you're listening to Professor Ellen Balka from the School of Communications at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, Canada. I'm Frieda Worden. I interviewed Balka at Campus Radio CJSF-FM in 2004. The problem she then studied in hospitals now affects most areas of life: the mismatch between undervalued human expertise and the rigid machines thrust on them.
Wow. So I'm starting to see, one, that when we're talking about ICTs, information communication technologies, the original ICT is human beings, and we're all programmed and have all kinds of data that we access, and that stuff's not necessarily visible to the people who are designing the machines. Now, one of the things I noticed in researching your background is that you have things on your website like participatory design. So given that you have a machine like the automatic drug dispensing machine, and you have people who need to use it, are there ways then that your research recommends so that those things don't happen, or are those things considered too insignificant and transient to worry about? I mean, how does the process of getting the machine developed and in there relate to the people who use it?
First, I want to say that's an excellent question. Thank you for that. In a perfect world, somebody like me works with an organization that is concerned about the impact of workplace changes on frontline staff, and also is working simultaneously with technology developers. And what somebody like I would do is try and develop an understanding of some of the tacit skill that is embodied in the worker, that the worker brings to the job, which typically is missed in computer system design. So when we talk about systems not working well, it's typically because whomever has designed the system hasn't had a very good understanding about how that system is actually used in a specific work context. And one of the consequences of that is that workers have to engage in a wide variety of tasks, some of which we refer to as workarounds. A workaround is when you can't get the technology to do what it's supposed to, you find an alternate means of accomplishing that task. Or you might have to engage in what's called articulation work. And articulation work is the kind of bridging work that you have to do to make the technology work as it's supposed to. And my favorite example of that is when you go buy a new piece of audio equipment or a new computer at the store, the vendor says, oh, you just take it home and plug it in and it'll work. And I mean, I don't know about you, but I don't know anybody that's been true for any time lately. Pretty well, you get the thing home and you unpack it and you start reading the directions, and the directions skip about 6 steps, and then there's some weird thing about your particular setup and your particular situation that means you have to do all this sort of figuring out and bridging in order to get the technology to work as advertised, and that's called articulation work. So when we go out and watch people work, what we're trying to understand is all the circumstances under which they're performing workarounds or they're performing articulation work. We operate on the basis of an assumption that plans are different from situated actions, that the way that we plan for a technology to work in a given situation will be dramatically different than the way it's actually used by workers. So that's kind of our starting point, and we go out and we try and understand what the situated actions are and how the situated actions work. And in my perfect universe, which unfortunately doesn't exist very often, we would feed that information directly back into technology designers. And every now and then that happens. But it doesn't always happen. Unfortunately, as a culture, we're accustomed to buying technologies that in some cases simply don't work, in other cases work poorly, and for some reason, culturally, we have become complacent. You know, we routinely buy computers that don't work. And we might not be happy about it, but seldom do we hold technology producers accountable for what their technologies don't do. And it's not in the technology producer's best short-term interest economically to invest a lot of money in improving the design of technology. So that's why it doesn't happen very often. But in the next best scenario, which is the one that we are trying to build with Vancouver Hospital at the moment, and which we have achieved some success at, we go out during the implementation of a new technology. And so another saying that it kind of underscores a lot of our work is that the design of technology is never fully completed until it's in use. So based on that, although we might have a physical system that in some sense can't be changed, there are still things that can be altered during the implementation that in fact can lead to improvements in how frontline workers experience their jobs and make their jobs easier. So the next best scenario is that we actually go in during the implementation and work again, the best scenario is if we can facilitate a process where frontline workers have direct input into the implementation process. And if we can't manage that, because of either the politics or the cost of pulling staff off the shop floor to participate in change activities. What we often do is work as a kind of go-between between frontline staff and management. We identify the issues that frontline staff are facing, we document them, we come up with proposed solutions, and we take them forward to management and try to get things dealt with.
So is there an example that you could give me of something where you have found that there were workarounds and things going on and you've been able to get a design change?
Sure. Rather than a design change, in this case, what we were able to do is to document a product defect, which resulted in having 80 units of something pulled out. And it's actually quite a, in a way, it's quite a funny story. In a way, it's quite a sad story. But we learned a lot from it, and it's something that I'm quite proud of. And again, this had to do with the move into the new building at Vancouver General Hospital last summer. One of the things that the health and safety people at the hospital had done is they were very concerned about repetitive strain injuries for staff using computers a lot, and they quite appropriately did a bunch of research and went out and invested money in acquiring good under-the-desk keyboard trays. Okay, for putting keyboards on that were adjustable so that when staff, for example, unit clerks, were at the computer all day long, they had a good working environment. And they made their purchasing decision based on a couple of these keyboard trays had been purchased for one unit and they had gotten really rave reviews and everybody liked them. So they went out and they made this decision to buy these new under-the-desk keyboard trays for the entire new building that was opening up, which is about 80 units of these keyboard trays. And when we were in doing our observation during the move into the new building and subsequent to the move into the new building, we had a great time. We designed, we had an SFU co-op student, and we asked her to design us a kind of tacky t-shirt. We called our campaign the Technology Trouble Campaign, and we had these really tacky, really, really bright t-shirts that said Technology Trouble, Talk to Us, and they had this huge, ugly logo on both sides, very, very visible, with information about how to contact us. And every time we went up onto the units, we wore these Technology Trouble Talk to Us t-shirts, which was an extremely effective means of getting staff to talk to us when they were too busy really to be doing anything but surviving and providing high-quality patient care. And so there we were out on the units with these Technology Trouble shirts on, inviting comments. And one of the comments we started hearing about a lot was these under-the-desk keyboard trays. And so we're hearing that there are all kinds of problems with the under-the-desk keyboard trays, and we start documenting them and so on. And to make a very long story very short, what we eventually found was that there were, in fact, manufacturing defects in all 80 units. And in fact, staff were complaining that they were too difficult to use, they weren't pulling out properly, and so on. And we were able to document this, and the result of it was that they pulled out the 80 units, they had the manufacturer correct the defects and put them back in. And if we hadn't been there, I think they'd probably still have staff complaining about the under-the-desk keyboard trays, and, you know, we had people that were banging their knees on them because they couldn't get them out properly and so on. And so that was a really nice project, because we were able to actually document a change, effect a change, and attach a dollar value to it. That was about a $35,000 problem that we solved. So I was very pleased about that.
Sometimes it's the little things. Maybe more often than not, it's the little things, eh? I wanted to ask you about the gender dimension of these things, because, again, looking at your website and seeing publications that were listed there and so forth, I saw some note that said that generally the technology designers are men and the technology end users of these kinds of communication technologies are quite more often women. And again, it's part of this, how do you get the information from the users to the designers and have it show up in the end product? But I wondered, because you have a background in women's studies, if you're seeing any gender-specific things that you'd like to mention here.
Sure. As I might have mentioned earlier, most of my work actually has had to do with looking at issues related to the introduction of technology into environments where women are the end users. And in fact, the way that I got into looking at health sector technology is the health sector is full of women workers. Most of your workers in hospitals are women. And so if you're interested in having a positive impact on women workers, hospitals are a great place to be because they're full of women workers. So, of course, most nurses are women. Most of the unit clerks who are doing the data entry and so on are women. Most of the people in health records are women. And these are all jobs that involve an enormous amount of technology. So if you think about something like the keyboard trays that I just mentioned, that's a really kind of interesting example because to get the keyboard trays fixed, we had to deal with maintenance. Maintenance is nearly all men. So one of the challenges that we had was actually getting that issue on the table so that maintenance kind of took it seriously as an issue because they're sort of, you know, all those women don't know how to use those keyboard trays, and that's why we're having, you know, there's really no issue for us to fix. So one of the things that often tends to happen is we tend to have, in general, in our culture, we have women's contributions undervalued. And when we have women's contributions undervalued, what that means is we tend to not hear what women say. So if women complain about a technology, it's often the complaint is dismissed often on the basis that, oh, it must just be those women that don't know how to use the technology. In other words, it's often dismissed as a user deficiency rather than as a technology deficiency. And we see an awful lot of that. We see an awful lot of that where there's a very much an assumption on the part of people responsible for both designing and implementing technologies that you bring the technology in and the workers should all adapt to the technology rather than the technology should actually support the workers. And So I see myself in a way as a translator. And what I do is I translate between different communities of people. I'm equally at ease talking with computer scientists and engineers as I am talking with nurses and unit clerks. And so I'm in a position where I'm able to take the concerns of the nurse or the unit clerk and represent those concerns to whether it's technology designers, whether it's people responsible for the implementation, that's part of what we do. And in a way, it's really fundamentally all about ensuring that women's voices are heard.
This was the first of a two-part interview with Professor Ellen Balka from the School of Communications at Simon Fraser University. Next week on Wings, she talks of teaching students to mediate humans' problems with technology.
If you take seriously this notion that technology reflects the values of the society in which it's produced, I think a logical extension of that is maybe we should try and make that process conscious.
To hear Wings shows again, email wings@wings.org or visit wingsradio.org/WordPress. You can also check out our daily news feed at facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings thanks our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, who hosts salons at maternalgifteconomymovement.org. That's maternalgifteconomymovement.org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.